Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming on the web at ksfr.org and podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'd like now to welcome T.R. Reid. He is the author of several books, the newest of which is The Healing of America, A Global Quest for Better, Cheaper, and Fairer Healthcare. T.R. Reid was a longtime correspondent for The Washington Post, former chief of its Tokyo and London bureaus, and he was a commentator for NPR, and has been on this show before, too. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, Mary Charlotte. Great to be back.
Good to have you. So having lived in London and Tokyo and traveled to many more countries and having had your own shoulder problem, which you sought help for on multiple continents, you've seen far more of the world's healthcare systems than most of us, including, I dare say, most of the legislators who are now crafting healthcare legislation. Outline for us the four major ways of funding healthcare that you've seen around the world, their manifestations in foreign countries and in this country.
Yeah, well, I went around the world to look at healthcare systems for a pretty simple reason. Everybody else, all the other industrialized democracies, managed to cover everybody with quality care, and they spend half as much as we do on healthcare. So how do you do that? And I just went around and took my sore shoulder with me to see what happens. And the interesting thing is they don't do it the same way. This idea we have that it's all big government, nanny state, socialized medicine, no, it's not so. As a matter of fact, there are several models. Some economists see 16 different models around the world, but, you know, I'm a journalist. I try to make this simple. So I found four basic models of healthcare around the world. In Britain, they have what's called the beverage model, and in that system, the basic rule is you should never get a doctor bill in your life. Most people in the countries with that system, Britain, Italy, Spain, New Zealand, never get a doctor bill, never get a hospital bill, because health care is the government's job. Government owns the hospitals, government employs most of the doctors, gives you the care, and you don't get a bill. It's just like the fire department or the public library. When you need the service, you get it. That was a pretty good system. I'd say that's about as close to socialized medicine as you can get if government provides the care and pays for it. Over on the continent of Europe, in countries like Germany, France, Switzerland, and again in Japan, they have a different model. That's the Bismarck model. It was invented by the first German chancellor, Otto von Bismarck. And that's kind of the mirror image. And that plan, it's all private. The doctors are private, the hospitals are private, and the insurance plans are private. And yet they manage to cover everybody and still spend half as much as we do using that system. The third model, I call it the national health insurance model, is kind of a mix of the two. In that system, the docs and hospitals, the providers, are private. And the payment scheme is government. This is a national health insurance program run by the government. The paradigm case of that is Canada. They invented that system. In Canada, the system of payment is called Medicare. And when Lyndon Johnson set up government health insurance for seniors in America in 1965, he borrowed the model and the name Medicare from Canada. That's used in Canada, in Australia, in Taiwan, South Korea. And then the fourth model is the most common model in the world because it's only like the 40 or 50 richest countries that have any health care system at all. And in the other countries, health care is under the out-of-pocket model. This is the standard in all the world's poor countries. It's pretty simple. If your child gets sick and you have some money in your pocket and can pay a doctor, she gets treated. If you don't have any money, your kid stays sick or dies. It's that simple. It's brutal.
So those are the four models, and the Medicare, the Canadian system, that single payer, exists here in the form of Medicare. The British system, the beverage system, where the whole hospital, the doctors, the whole thing is really owned and run by the government and funded by taxes, we have that here, too, in a couple of different forms.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Now, look, we don't want to tell my publisher, but at the end of this round-the-world trip, I figured out I didn't have to go around the world to see all the models because we've got them all right here. You're right. If you're a veteran or a Navy American, a Native American, I'm sorry, veteran or Native American, those people live in Britain for health care. They get care in the Beveridge model, the British model, where government provides the care and you don't get a bill. Government pays. If you're over 65 and on Medicare, you're using private doctors but a public insurance system, well, you live in Canada for health care purposes. That's the Canadian model, Medicare. If you're getting health insurance from your employer and splitting the cost with the employer for the premium, well, that's the German model. You live in Germany for health care purposes. That's the Bismarck model of health care. And for the tens of millions of Americans who don't have any coverage, well, they're in the out-of-pocket system. They live in Afghanistan or Angola because that's the same system that all the poor countries have. We've got them all.
Now, when we talk about the employer system that we have, so, you know, I work here at a radio station. I pay my share. The radio station pays its share. I have private health insurance coverage. In a way, that's like the German system, the Japanese system. But in a number of other very significant ways, it's way different. One of the ways that it's different is that no other country, except for the United States, even allows for-profit health insurance in the first place.
Yeah, that's exactly right. There are countries, many countries, on this Bismarck model with private docs and private insurance. But the insurance is regulated much more than ours, and therefore it turns out to be better insurance. Get this, in those other countries, they have to sell insurance to anybody who applies. You can switch to another company if you don't like your insurance and they can't raise your premium. The insurance companies have to pay any claim that's submitted by a doctor or a hospital. Usually they have to pay it pretty quickly. And in Switzerland, if your insurance company doesn't pay your claim within 5 days, then your next month's premium is free. So that's better insurance than anybody else has. And the government, the main regulation is the government puts controls on their administrative costs, how much they can add to the bill. So, for example, in France, it's 61 million people and 14 insurers, and their administrative costs are 4%. In American private insurance, the administrative cost averages 20%. That is, they add 20% to every doctor bill they pay. So American health insurance is crueler. They don't pay everything. They don't cover everybody. And much more expensive than the health insurance in any other country.
How do these other countries keep costs down? In other words, who is negotiating with whom as to what health care should cost and does cost?
It depends on the system. In the British system, since the government pays all the bills, government controls costs. Government basically tells the doctors and hospitals what it's going to pay. They negotiate. In Britain, the government, the National Health Service, buys all the medications and then passes them out to the patients. And guess what? The same pill made in the same factory cost 20 cents a pill in Britain and $1.20 in the United States because we don't have somebody negotiating for cost control like that. In Germany, the health insurers negotiate with the doctors every 2 years to set a price scheme and with the hospitals to set a control. In Japan, they have the same negotiation, but the negotiation is done by the government, by the health ministry, which then establishes prices for what the system is going to pay. And all the insurers pay the same fee for the same service. And what happens there is, because the system has so much negotiating power, it really controls costs. The system basically says to the doctors, this is what you're going to get for replacing a knee. And there's nowhere else they can go for the most part. That's their customer for the doctors. And so, for example, in my case, you know, I have this bum shoulder. And I started off in the United States, and the doctor in the U.S., a very good doctor, said to me, well, look, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to replace your shoulder with an artificial shoulder made out of titanium. It's going to be great. Would have been about $47,000. In France, the system offered me the exact same procedure. It would have cost $6,000. Because they negotiate cost controls. And that's a fundamental reason why, one of the reasons, not the only one, but it's a fundamental reason why our health care costs so much more than everybody else's.
Let's talk about where that money is going. Who is getting wealthy? I mean, we know who's losing, which is the many people who are going bankrupt. What is it, 700,000 people?
Yeah, by many estimates, 700,000 Americans go bankrupt every year because of health care costs. That's another thing the other countries don't allow. You know how many Brits go bankrupt because of medical bills? Zero. France, zero. Germany, zero. Japan, zero. Switzerland, zero. Other countries don't let that happen. But in the U.S., yeah, 700,000 people a year go bankrupt because they happen to get sick or got hit by a truck or something.
So, meanwhile, who is getting rich?
Well, in our system, the big winners at the moment are health insurance companies, the most lucrative health insurance companies in the world. They charge the most, and they add the most in administrative costs. And, of course, health insurance executives make huge amounts. On average, they make more than oil company executives. They make more than the people running Citibank and Goldman Sachs. Health insurance in America is an incredibly lucrative field, and that's why Wall Street loves the health insurance companies. A lot of hospital corporations are doing just great in the current system, and many doctors. There are a lot of specialists in America who make $1 million a year, and that's just about unthinkable anywhere else in the world. There just aren't medical specialties making the kind of money doctors do in America. Not all doctors do. I mean, a lot of family doctors make as much as the local banker, you know, or the owner of an electronics store or something. But medical specialists in America are really cashing in. So there are certain groups that are winning big in the current system, and that's one of the reasons it's so hard to change, because you know, there are big winners with huge amounts of money to pour into the political process to protect the status quo.
We're talking to T.R. Reid, author of the book The Healing of America, A Global Quest for Better, Cheaper, and Fairer Healthcare. There are certainly among doctors fabulously wealthy people with their mansions and the whole thing, and their boats and so on. But a lot of doctors, they come out of medical school with huge student loans. They face huge malpractice premiums. In other countries, doctors are, as you say, you know, prosperous middle-class people, not wealthy. But their education is paid for. They're debt-free after medical school. Okay, that makes it good. How do they deal with the problem of malpractice in other places that you've studied?
Yeah, that's another important distinction. The doctors make less, but they don't graduate with this huge debt. And they generally, many doctors do pay malpractice premiums, but they're tiny. In fact, when I asked the doctor, I spent a week with a doctor in Japan. He owns a small clinic with 9 beds. It's a 9-bed hospital. What's your malpractice premium? Gosh, I don't know. It's very hard to find an American doctor who doesn't know what his malpractice premium costs. Anyway, we checked with the office manager, and his malpractice cost was about $30 a month. We can't say for sure, because in the $30 per month, he also gets a subscription to a magazine and some other stuff. Basically nothing. And these doctors don't get sued. This is just not the method that other countries use. Look, every country has to worry about compensating patients who are injured by medical errors. It's a problem everywhere. Nobody else does it through the tort system. It's only the United States that does that, and it hasn't worked all that well in the United States. It really doesn't get the compensation to the people who need it. But and therefore, other countries have not accepted this way of doing it, and therefore, both the lack of medical school debt and the very, very low malpractice premiums, no threat of being sued, really helps out doctors and others. So even though they earn less, they come out pretty well, because they don't have those burdens that American doctors do.
Another burden that they don't have is the bureaucratic nightmare caused by having so very many different insurance payers to deal with.
Yeah. That's absolutely right, and America just has a ridiculously complicated and expensive system. You know, an average doctor in the back room, they have 100 different forms. If you have any kind of complicated procedure and ask your doctor what it's going to cost, the doctor, the woman who's going to do the procedure, she doesn't know what it's going to cost, because it varies depending on the plan. In contrast, in other countries, there's one set of rules, one set of forms, and often one price. Get this. You go to the doctor in Canada, And she's required to post on the wall what she's going to charge for every procedure. She has one column, what the price is. The second column is how much the insurance system is going to pay you back. And the third one is how many days before you get repaid by the health insurance plan. It's usually 2 weeks in France. No American doctor could post that chart because they don't know. They don't know what they're going to get paid, and nobody knows what your insurance company is going to give you back. So it's incredibly costly and complicated. I went to this giant hospital in Canada, 800 beds, and the president of the hospital is proudly giving me a tour of all his facilities. And I said, where's the billing office? He got kind of embarrassed. He said, oh, yeah, the billing office. It's two part-timers who spend 2 days a month doing the billing. They just send a record to the government, and that's it. It's done. An American hospital with 800 beds would have 200 people doing the billing.
So when you look at the position of doctors, on the one hand, if there is serious health care reform that includes price negotiations even for the procedures that they're doing, you could see that there would be some resistance to it. But on the other hand, if you could get rid of this bureaucratic nightmare, it would be very helpful to them. The doctors that you've talked to in this country, where do they stand? What do they say?
Well, traditionally, I'd say up until the 21st century, doctors tended to oppose so-called health care reform, any approach toward a unified plan, just because they were afraid of that. That plan would cut their costs. Today, docs are so frustrated with the system. They're incredibly frustrated with the cost and the complexity and the changing rules that gets between them and their patients that many, many doctors now would like to see a much simpler plan, even though they know it would probably cut their income. At a recent AMA convention, American Medical Association, that's pretty conservative establishment doctors, 59% said they favored a government-run single-payer system, even though if you had that, then that system would have enormous economic clout and would probably reduce their income. But, you know, the docs I know, you talk to people who are doctors, they got into it. They like science, they like biology, and they want to use the talent they've got to help people. And they're really frustrated by the system they have to work in. So I think docs are ready for change. I don't think the insurance companies are. The hospital companies aren't so likely. But doctors, I think, in America are ready to see a fix because the system they've got is just making their life very difficult and making it hard for them to treat their patients.
In terms of keeping costs down, there are really some brilliant silver linings. And one example was from Japan. So there's a fixed price for an MRI, and the doctors can't charge more than that because the prices are negotiated. On the one hand, the doctors complain about that. On the other hand, that has created a demand for lower-priced but very high-functioning MRI machines, which then suppliers supplied. And that actually, those price controls actually encouraged innovation in the marketplace.
Yeah, I have a lot of that in my book. There's no question that strict cost controls drive innovation in other countries. And that's interesting because we're told by our drug companies and device makers, research, you know, that, hey, if we cut costs in America for healthcare, we're going to cut research. It turns out not to be true. Other countries with much lower cost structures are just as innovative as the United States. I mean, we have world-class research, but so do they. I'll tell you this. Anybody out there who's listening who's had an artificial knee or an artificial hip inserted, they're standing on French technology. This new treatment for Alzheimer's or for depression, deep brain stimulation, that's a Canadian invention. Even the drug industry's greatest invention, Viagra, that was invented in Britain. So the fact is, as I say in my book, cost controls drive innovation. The argument that we got to pay through the nose to get good medical research, it just doesn't hold up.
One thing that is universal all around the world, as you write in your book, is that no matter how good the healthcare system is in a particular country, the people will complain about it. At the same time, they also look at the United States and say, boy, we're glad we're not like you. What do they say about us? What are you hearing other countries say about us?
Yeah, during our debate this summer, a lot of people said, oh, my gosh, we don't want to be like those foreign countries. They pull the plug on grandma and all that stuff. Socialized medicine is a bad word. the bad word in the rest of the world when it comes to healthcare is American style. And I heard this everywhere. They all have this kind of smug superiority. They know that we don't cover everybody. They know that lots of Americans die and hundreds of thousands go bankrupt in our healthcare system. And it doesn't happen in those countries. So they feel superior. When I lived in Britain, you know how in Britain the Prime Minister once a week stands up in Parliament and takes questions from the opposing party, Prime Minister's questions? And when I lived there, it was very common for the opposition parties to stand up and rail about the National Health Service. Well, a woman in my constituency was left in a gurney in the hospital for 3 days. This is outrageous, you know. The Prime Minister, either Tony Blair or Gordon Brown, always answered the same way. They would say, well, obviously, the honorable gentleman opposite wants to impose American-style for-profit corporate medicine. This we will never do. And everybody would cheer and wave because we are the boogeyman. And it makes all over the world, they feel superior to us because they think we're just ruthless. We don't care about people, and that's why we let people die of treatable diseases. I was up in Canada. You know, Canadians, they're nice people. They're kind of laid back. They're understated. And this woman at the health ministry said to me, you know, we don't brag a lot. You know, we don't go around chanting we're number one like some countries I know. But she said there are a couple of areas where we're better than you, hockey and healthcare.
There we have it.
Yeah, that's their view, yeah.
We're talking to T.R. Reid. He is the author of the brand new book, which I'm happy to say is already a bestseller, called The Healing of America, A Global Quest for Better, Cheaper, and Fairer Health Care. One problem, and I was thinking about this when I was reading your chapter on the Canadian system and how they have a very egalitarian ethic in that country. And even when there's one single-payer system that covers everybody, there's a real resistance if there are people who want to have extra supplementary insurance and so on to having a two-tiered system. In this country, we have a long and deep history of a two-tiered or multi-tiered society. You've got slavery as a very deep part of our consciousness, and then Jim Crow, and then the poor treatment of immigrants to this day. I've heard people who object to health care reform because they don't want undocumented immigrants to receive any treatment. How do other countries deal with non-citizens in their countries?
You know, a lot of countries have anti-immigration movements now. There's a lot of concern about illegal immigration all over Europe. The Japanese, I think, are pretty xenophobic. They don't like all that immigration either. And all these countries have nationalist parties, you know, like Tom Tancredo in our country, who build whole parties around anti-immigration stances. But interestingly, they don't apply it to healthcare. If you live in the country, you're in the system. They treat everybody. I think they figure if a child breaks his leg or has asthma, they're going to treat that kid, whether or not his parents have come to the country legally. It's just not an issue anywhere else.
And yet here, have you heard that objection?
Oh, yeah, I've heard it. In fact, I'm still kind of mystified by the anger that came out this summer in America over health care reform. And as a political reporter, the last time I saw that level of anger was over the immigration question. People who are upset about illegal immigration are really furious about it. And I saw that same level of anger at these town meetings, at some of them anyway. So it's not surprising to me that the immigration issue would merge with the health care issue, but it's really not an issue in our country because I think everybody in Washington has agreed whatever they do, they're not going to cover illegal aliens. I think we cover children. I think whether or not your dad got here legally, if you're a sick child, most states are going to cover that kid, and that seems right to me. I just don't think we should let kids go to school with a broken ankle because of something their dad did. But, we're much less willing to treat people who are here illegally than other countries are.
So even with all the money we spend, we're not particularly healthy compared to other countries. And one of the measurements is not longevity per se, but healthy. What is it that you call it in your book? Getting to a healthy old age.
Healthy life expectancy at age 60.
Right.
Yeah. That's a really striking one. That's a very standard measure. All the comparative studies use it. And what it asks is, the day you turn 60, how long can you expect to live before you get the standard diseases of old age, bad back, rheumatoid arthritis, whatever, Alzheimer's, etc. And the astonishing, to me kind of depressing fact is, of the 23 richest countries in the world, the U.S. ranks last in terms of healthy life expectancy at age 60. That is, the other countries are doing a better job of keeping their seniors alive and healthy than the world's richest country. And a lot of the reason for that is so many people just don't have access to health care, particularly before they go on Medicare.
How do they do preventive care in some of these other countries that you've studied?
I think most of the countries I went to, and again, they were mainly rich, you know, industrialized democracies, to me, do a better job than we do on preventive health care. And I think the reason is pretty clear. Everybody's in the same system, cradle to grave, so the system has an interest in keeping you healthy. Preventive health care is a good thing. It reduces suffering. It probably saves the system a lot of money, but it costs money to do it. And therefore, you need an incentive. And you look at our system, it's not really there. The average customer in America stays with a private health insurance company on average 5.8 years. So by the time he gets sick, you're going to be some other company's problem. And therefore, the insurance companies, they have to pay a profit to their investors. They don't have an incentive to keep you healthy. In the other countries, you're going to be in that system, whether it's a government-run system or private, for life, and therefore they do have an incentive. And to me, the world champion in preventive health was Britain. When we lived in Britain, you know, you walk down the street and there's a big billboard. Do your feet hurt? Call this 800 number and we'll send a podiatrist to your house for free, because they want to know if your feet hurt, whether you have incipient diabetes. They'd rather treat it early. Does your back hurt? Call this 800 number. We'll send a doctor free. They have this ad on TV where mom is cooking dinner for the kids. You know, she's cooking in a big pot. It's some, you know, it's porridge or one of those disgusting British dinners. And she's making dinner. And while she's she's coughing and just really sounds bad. And the kids look worried and they say, Mom, are you okay? And then the announcer says, is mom coughing a lot? It could be chronic bronchitis. Call this 800 number and we'll send a nurse to your house for free. That's what they do in Britain. They just really look out for you. And I once said to the health minister in Britain when I was over there, you know, I really like living in this country because I just get the impression that a lot of people are spending a lot of time and intelligence to keep me healthy. And the health minister, here's what he said. He said, of course we do. Of course we do. He said, I'll tell you why. You know, they have a single national health service, treats everybody. He said, from the minute the line turns blue on your mother's pregnancy test until the minute you flatline in the hospital 90 years later, you're my patient. Of course I want to keep you healthy. And see, that's an economic incentive, and it's a stronger one than we have, and that's why what I found is that other countries generally do better on preventive care than we do.
We're talking to T.R. Reid. His new book is called The Healing of America, A Global Quest for Better, Cheaper, and Fairer Healthcare. When you look at the various healthcare reform proposals before Congress, do any of them build in an economic incentive toward preventive care, toward actual maintenance of healthcare, as opposed to treating things when they get really bad?
No. But then we don't know the plan yet. You know, the plan has not been determined. It looks like Congress is going to direct a basic package of benefits that the health insurance companies have to provide. And that may well include preventive care. We don't know yet what it's going to include. But the main issue is, and particularly in America where everybody switches to government health care at age 65, that's when most of these latent diseases appear. So there's as long as we have many different systems and people pass through five or six different insurance plans in their life until they get to Medicare, there's really not going to be the kind of incentive that other countries have to worry about keeping you healthy. Their worry is keep you going until you switch jobs or you get too old and go to Medicare, and then you're not their problem.
Let's talk for a moment about the public option, though. As the, I mean, the House bills are written and have included it. What are the stuff that's passed so far? The Senate is still, I guess, trying to work that out. But the public option would only be one of several options and would not even be available right away to everybody at the beginning. But it's something like a single-payer Medicare system in its essence. Do you think that's a good way of doing it?
Yeah, it's a way. I mean, as long as you make it optional so that Americans have the choice to choose private insurance if they want. President Obama said when he was running for president that he was going to support a public option available to all Americans. And the prime reason was to give our health insurers some competition. As I said earlier, you know, in the other countries, they have private insurers, but they're really closely regulated. They have strict rules about what they have to do and how much they can charge. We don't have that kind of regulation here, but a public option would provide a competitor, in theory, that would force the other insurance companies to lower their prices and to treat people fairly, to pay every claim like they do overseas. But, you know, we don't know what the public option is going to look like. In the current House bills, they just don't cover everybody. And if they don't cover everybody, then you don't get the competition that's supposed to keep the insurance companies honest. You know, in America, about 50% of the Americans who have insurance don't have any choice. Their employer provides one plan, and that's what you get. I work for a really big company, and I have one choice. I only have one plan. So even if there were just one public plan out there, it would double my choices, and I think would force my private insurer to lower prices. That's the theory behind it. No other country has a public option because other countries either have one single-payer system or they have many competing insurance companies. In Germany, get this, they have 220 private insurance companies. Anybody in Germany can buy any one of those 220 plans. If you don't like your plan, you can drop it on 60 days' notice and switch to another guy. The other company has to accept you and can't raise your premiums. Now, that's competitive health insurance. That's much more choice than any American has. We don't have that, and I think that's part of the theory of the public option, is to give people more choices. If you work for the government and you live in Washington, D.C., they have marvelous choices. This is what Congress gets. They can choose among 32 different health insurance plans, and the government sets rules for what these companies have to do and how much they can charge to get listed in the government plan. That's really a good system, and people get good insurance in that deal for a good price. To make that available to everybody, the same thing Congress and government employees have, I think that would be a really good solution. It would give people many more choices and would force the insurers to compete against each other and keep the prices down.
As you've written in your book, there is no system out there, including here, that has universal coverage and private health insurance.
No. For-profit is what they don't have.
That's what I meant. For-profit.
Many countries have Germany, Belgium, France, Switzerland, Netherlands, Japan. They cover everybody through the private plan. But the fundamental distinction is their insurance companies only exist to pay for people's health care. They don't exist to make a profit. And the reason is all the other countries have decided that there's a fundamental conflict between paying for people's health care and paying a dividend to investors every quarter. This is an important distinction because you can divide health care into two halves, the provider part, that is doctors, nurses, labs, drug companies, the people who provide health care, and then the payment system. And most of the countries I went to, not all but most, they have no problem with the providers making profit. In fact, in Japan, there are more for-profit hospitals than there are in America. That's perfectly fine. Docs can make a profit, private drug companies. But all these countries have decided that the insurance scheme has to be non-profit, because once you let insurers make a profit on basic health care, well, then they do what American insurers do. They stop covering anybody who might ever make a claim. That's the pre-existing condition. They employ thousands and thousands of people to go through and deny claims. You know, Mary Charlotte, I bet everybody listening to this program has had a claim denied by the insurance companies. In foreign countries where the insurers are nonprofit, they have to pay every claim.
So there are covered procedures, and if it's on that list of covered procedures, the insurance company has to provide it. What's in it for a private nonprofit insurance company in say, Germany?
Well, they compete with each other, as a matter of fact, even though they make a profit. Here's why. In most of those countries, the executive pay scales are dictated by how many customers you've got. So the more customers you can win to your plan, the better your pay. You don't make profit, but they just do better. They're more prestigious, and they make higher salaries. And therefore, they do compete for care. Switzerland has an interesting deal. Switzerland, you know, has big international insurance companies. They are required to offer health insurance to everybody on a nonprofit basis for the basic plan. But the same companies can sell supplemental insurance to cover things that aren't in the basic package, like, you know, Botox or hair replacement or breast enlargement, something like that. And they can make a profit on the supplemental coverage. And then in Switzerland, the same company that sells you basic health insurance on a nonprofit basis also sells life insurance. They sell fire insurance. And so they use their good service and fast payment on health insurance to draw in customers for the profit-making lines, and they're doing fine. When Switzerland switched to nonprofit insurance, that was 1994, all the insurance companies and all the drug companies opposed it because they thought, well, gee, you know, they're gonna shaft us. Today, all the insurance industry supports us. They've done fine under it, and they also have the satisfaction of knowing they live in a country where everybody is covered. You know, I went around and interviewed the chairman of almost all the biggest health insurers in America, and every one of them said to me, gee, what I really want to do is I want to see every American have health insurance. Well, you know, they've been saying that for 30 years, and fewer have health insurance every year, so it's just not working here.
We're talking to T.R. Reid. His new book is called The Healing of America, A Global Quest for Better, Cheaper, and Fairer Healthcare. We have, as you've said, all four systems, and for that reason, we don't have, and we have a lot of people who don't have health insurance, so for that reason, we don't really have a large consolidated risk pool of insured people. Well, the VA, the Indian Health Services, Medicare, they aren't going anywhere. What do you think is the best solution for us?
Well, my family lived in Britain. You know, that's the system I told you about where you never get a bill. Here's what happens in Britain. Your child, you know, wakes up with an earache, for example. We would call the doctor. She always came the same day. She usually came to our house within 2 hours. They make house calls. She treats your doctor, and, I believe it's otitis media, she says. He's got an earache. She gives her a shot of penicillin. Your kid feels better. The parent feels better. And then you know what happens? She walks out the door. There's no bill. There's no copay. There's no deductible. There's no nothing. So, boy, I tell you, as a husband, as a father, as a patient, I like that system. But I think it's probably too big government for the United States, although we do use it for our veterans, you know. But the insurance systems that I saw in other countries, Germany, Japan, et cetera, they're all private. But they have these tight controls, this tight regulation of health insurance to make it deal with people fairly and cover everybody. I think we could import a lot of their rules and a lot of their procedures here. And then another thing is, in those countries that have a unified system, I'm not saying single payer. There are, a lot of them have many payers. Japan has 3,000 payers, but they have a single set of rules and a single set of forms, and many of them, particularly in Europe, are now onto a system without any paper. Everybody has a little plastic card that's their medical card, and their medical record is on it, and this just vastly improves the speed of the system, and it reduces medical errors, and it makes things much cheaper to operate. In France, everybody in France, 61 million people, has this little green card. I think you saw it in my book, the Carte Vitale, with their medical records on it, and therefore French doctors have no billing office, and no files full of patients' records. It's all on the card. And France got there in 2004. Now, the United States has officially set a goal that by 2014, we want to have half of Americans have a digital and electronic medical record. So think about that. Does this make you feel good? Just, we're going to be half as good as France 10 years later.
Right.
Make you proud?
Well, it's, I mean, the thing that I think is so horrifying. I mean, I listened to the news about this. Clearly nobody has read your book. Clearly nobody has lived abroad. And it's like, it's not that we have to invent these answers from whole cloth. They're really out there. There's so much to choose from. And as you, I love that list you had of innovations that we have accepted from other countries. The interstate highway system, text messaging, yoga, sushi, American Idol. These are all imports from other countries.
Yeah, yeah. So if we're willing to take those basic parts of American life from other countries, why not healthcare? I think we definitely could. There's a lot we could learn from the other countries. I'm not talking about Cuba or Russia. I focused on advanced, free market, industrialized democracies, countries like us. They've all faced the same problems. Everybody has an aging population. Everybody has to deal with the rapidly rising costs of healthcare. And everybody's got problems. No country system is perfect. But they've all done a better job than we have, and they all cover everybody. So, yeah, that was my argument. Certainly, we can learn from them. We're kind of bound by these myths. Well, it's all socialized medicine. Well, as you saw in my book, it's not. I mean, some countries have socialized medicine, but many are just as private or more private than our system. Well, you know, well, yeah, but they have long waiting lines, and they keep people waiting, and they limit choices. Yeah, in some countries that's true. Canada, I'm pretty tough on Canada in my book because they keep you waiting a long time. But many countries, Germany, France, Netherlands, particularly Japan, on standard measures like waiting time for an appointment, waiting time for elective surgery, they do better than the United States. And as for choice, in France, in Germany, in Britain, you can go to any doctor or any hospital in the country without any kind of pre-authorization. This business of in-network, and if you happen to run into a doctor who's not in the network, they charge you $4,000 or something.
Right, right.
Yeah. In Japan, every doctor and every hospital is in-network. You go, and the insurance has to pay. So other countries, actually, many of them have more choice than Americans and often have shorter waiting time. So a lot of the stuff we think we know about healthcare overseas is wrong, and I think if we woke up to this, we might be more willing to borrow ideas from overseas. And the good news is my book is selling like mad, and maybe people will figure out that there are good ideas over there that we could use.
I think one thing that's worth noting and really emphasizing is that in healthcare reform here in the U.S., if you mandate insurance for all employers and all individuals, in other words, everybody has to buy insurance, and if you subsidize those who can't afford the insurance and don't have any public insurance plan, no public option, then you're basically taking money out of the taxpayers' pockets and enhancing the profits of the private insurance companies.
Yeah, if that's the way the thing came out, and of course that's the plan the insurance industry has endorsed, they'll cover everybody in return for a law saying everybody has to buy their product. They would make out, but I think part of that package has to be some of the regulation that I saw in other countries. They should be required to pay any claim submitted by a doctor. They haven't agreed to that yet. They should be required to pay a claim within 2 weeks. There's no reason they should sit around for 3 months waiting to pay your claim. They don't have to do that. This business that the American insurers have called rescission, where you pay your premiums for years, you get hit by a truck and have a $500,000 bill, and they send you letters saying you're canceled, that's not allowed in any other country, and that should be banned as well in America. And then there should be limits on their administrative costs. You know, if insurance companies in Germany can cover everybody and have a 5% administrative cost, why don't we impose that in America? So I don't have any problem saying everybody should have insurance. It seems to me a matter of basic individual responsibility that you insure your own health. That's fine with me as long as the companies are required to meet certain rules. Cover everybody, pay every claim, don't cut people off, and put some limit on these outrageous administrative costs that are higher than any other system in the world.
We're talking to T.R. Reid. His new book is called The Healing of America, A Global Quest for Better, Cheaper, and Fairer Healthcare. When you were here in Santa Fe earlier this year, you talked about this moment when you went to brief a, I think it was a congressional committee, about what you had learned from other countries, and they said, well, if we're going to do healthcare reform soon, what should be our strategy? And you basically said, demonize the health insurance companies. They're the bad guys. And all of them, except for like one, said, oh, shucks, we couldn't do that. What strategies are in use at this point politically that you see?
Yeah, well, what I pointed out to the Senate Finance Committee was, it's not all socialized medicine. As I said, a lot of countries have private insurance, but they have strict controls on these insurance companies, and one of them is they don't make a profit. Paying for people's health insurance is a nonprofit endeavor in the other countries. And one of the members, Ken Salazar, who was my senator at the time, said, well, how would you recommend we convince the American health insurance industry to give up its profit? You know, it's a hugely profitable business. And I said, well, I don't think you'll ever convince them. I think you have to run against them. You have to impose this on them, and it shouldn't be that hard because people don't like their health insurance companies. And as you say, they were all terrified. You know, oh, my God, do you know how much money those companies have? And, you know, if you think about it, President Obama's idea of a public option was supposed to achieve the same kind of thing. I think it's not a bad idea. It doesn't take away anybody's right to buy private insurance. If you don't think government can pay for your health care, fine. You can still buy from WellPoint or Aetna or Blue Cross. That's fine. But if you have a one other plan that people can choose as an option, well, then in theory, that's going to force the private insurers to get their costs down. In other words, you could get the same place without regulating the insurance companies. The interesting thing that's happened in our debate is the insurance industry is so frightened of competing against a public option that they are now willing to accept some degree of regulation if the government will give up this public option. I just don't think they've accepted enough regulation. They still haven't agreed to pay every claim. They haven't agreed to any time limit on when they pay the claim. You know, they're still going to sit on your money for 60, 90 days before they pay. I think if we got all those, then we'd be much closer to the health insurance systems that work pretty well in other countries.
T.R. Reid is a journalist, a longtime correspondent for the Washington Post and former chief of its Tokyo and London bureaus, a commentator for National Public Radio, and the author of several books, the latest of which is The Healing of America, A Global Quest for Better, Cheaper, and Fairer Healthcare. Thank you so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Delighted. I love your show, Mary Charlotte. It was great.
Thank you. I love your book, and I'm glad it's doing so well.
Oh, great. Thanks a lot.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org. We're podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, Good Morning Jazz presents bassist Christian McBride.